Should we start? Maybe, Carol, do you want to start off with that? There was a show on PBS about the neutrino. If you remember, Pauly was he discovered it. He predicted its theoretical existence, or he predicted its existence theoretically, and then, about 20 years later, it was confirmed. But there was a show on PBS about it, and why don't you tell us about it?
Well, Pauly predicted the neutrino because in radioactive decay, when an electron is emitted, it doesn't account for all the energy that's emitted, and some of it seems to be lost. So Pauly theorized the neutrino, and they thought that the neutrino was massless. It had no mass, but they've done experiments in over the past 30 years, which they couldn't reconcile their results, but finally they reconciled them and they found that the neutrino does have mass. And this was NOVA that was on Tuesday night, but it's going to be rebroadcast.
It will be rebroadcast Sunday morning at 2 a.m. Well, it's one of those things, they rebroadcast it. You could say, you know, if you ever record it, you could record it. That's the idea. I'll try to record it. Sunday at 2 a.m., channel 20.
Yes.
This Sunday
at 2 a.m., yeah.
Well, I asked my mom about casket.
Uh-huh.
And she says, yeah, it's a little box.
A little box.
Especially a jewelry box. And so I looked up the origin of the word, and it says that the idea of casket, meaning coffin, is an American idea that first came about in like 1849 or so, and it was considered maybe a euphemism, and Hawthorne thought it was a vile thing because they took the word.
Oh, like a treasure, treasure chest, and turned it into a coffin.
But it also might be from the French word cassette, meaning little box.
Oh, okay.
But definitely, that's how it.
Yeah, that's
how it's used in Europe.
That must be what it meant then—a small box or like a jewelry box sort of idea.
Mm-hmm. Especially jewelry, something that holds jewels.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Yeah, that neutrino thing. We talked about it very briefly. Maybe not even here, but in another one. You probably remember from chemistry or high school physics that there's in the atoms got a nucleus, right? And inside, they used to say there was a neutron and then some protons. That was like what you learned in high school. And since then, they found there's a gazillion other teensy, very small particles inside there. And that's really what physics has been researching the last 20, 30 years.
My favorite is the quark.
The quark.
Quark, named after James Joyce's word that he had in the Ulysses. It's called a quark. Quark or quark.
And the neutrino is one of them. And Pauly posited it. And it's become, I guess, an object of study over the last 20 years. And that's what that show is about. So.
You saw that.
Neutrino. It was, I think, Enrico Fermi, the Italian, coined the name. And it meant a little neutron because I think it's electrically neutral. Does that sound right, Carol? So it was really the beginning. I don't know if it was the beginning, but it's part of the beginning of particle physics, which is they pretty much know how electrons work, but what they've been doing is exploring inside the nucleus. And that's why they have these huge atom smashers to get atoms going so fast that when they collide, it impacts on the nucleus. What we really have been talking about, what Pauly really worked on, was the behavior of electrons. And, you know, that's many, many, many orders of magnitude different. I forget the analogy that I heard, but I think if you think of an atom as a football field, a football stadium, and you think of the seats around the stadium as the orbits of the electron, the space occupied by the nucleus would be a pinhead in the center of the football field. That's how small we're working, and these guys are working on the behavior of the electron, but now physics has moved into examining the nature of the nucleus. And where we learned in high school, there were there were protons and neutrons inside the nucleus. Now there's many, 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 many different ones they found. Much, much, much smaller than the protons and neutrons. So send me to a. I will try to record it. I caught the very tail end of it, but I wanted to see what they said about Pauli.
In the beginning, they talk about
Pauli. They talk about Pauli. Okay, quick review. excuse me. Dreams we've had so far. Fire, we talked about. We talked about the oscillations. We talked about the flood in the Persians, in the Persian. And last week, we basically focused on that dream of the Inquisition and the men whose wives objectified rotation being subject to the investigation. We talked very briefly about the history of the beginning of science. I won't go through the dates again, but just so you hear the names again. Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler, Descartes, Newton were some of the major players from about 1530 to about 1687, until our current view of the universe was established, 1687, and that held sway until Pauli, and those guys showed its limits. So Pauli was really at the beginning of a major shift in the way we understand the nature of matter and movement. Big idea with the Inquisition dream was that it was that period of history represented the projection of what we understand to be the self externally. And prior to that, it had not received recognition in such a strong way as it began to receive then. It really moved to front and center of our worldview, this idea of circulation. And we know circulation as one of the dimensions of the mandala, and they began to be fascinated by circulation by seeing it externally. So in the dream, you could say the judges who are trying these individuals do not want to admit the existence of the self on any plane. And that is something we still struggle with. Anybody in therapy struggles with that. The forces that do not want them to become an individual. And it's always a battle. Who's going to win? The drive to individuality or the forces in them that want to destroy the development of their own individual personality for the sake of remaining a sheep, one of the cogs in the wheel. And then people go through all sorts of dances and machinations to try to appear like individuals, when in fact they're simply putting on a garb that gives them the feeling of specialness, and they are living a completely collective life. A subtext to that dream, which is not manifest, but which is hidden in there, is that the anima is unconscious, and the criticism, you could say, doesn't come from the judges, but it's implied in the point of view of the dream that there's a criticism from the point of view of the self, that there's no relationship to the anima. Because the wives objectified rotation and the men didn't know where their wives were. So it's sort of an ambiguous dream. On the one hand, it shows the forces against individuation. On the other hand, it shows the forces for individuation, in that we get, by implication only, this idea of not being in touch with the anima. So that was a little difficult to get our heads around, I thought, at least for me. We talked about Kepler, who was the fellow who began to give a mathematical description of the movement of the planets. And he was in conflict with an alchemist in England who wanted to understand that the movements of the planets came from the soul of the universe, And Kepler was saying, no, that is not what is important here. We should be looking at the nature of a God who oversees this movement, and we see that relationship between God and the universe in the regularity of the movements. Two things happened there. One, that opened up science to mathematically investigate the universe and allowed science to have its strength and power, which has produced many wonderful things. We wouldn't be sitting in this room without that. On the other hand, it excluded the whole concept of the world soul, which we are forced to reevaluate if we begin to take synchronicity seriously, because synchronicity is not predictable, although the movements of large objects seems to be predictable. A couple of questions which I said I'd check on. One, Kepler's nationality. Actually, he was German. And was on the run a lot of his life for having said controversial things. So basically he had to leave Germany, then he went to Czechoslovakia, and he was in Prague, and when he was in Prague, he had to leave Prague because he was Protestant, and ended up in Austria, I think in Linz, and then I think returned to Germany, I believe. So basically he was German. We had a discussion too, and I was way off the mark, on Ptolemy, P-T-O-L-E-M-Y. He was actually Greek, living in Alexandria. He's the guy who expressed the model of the universe that held until the beginning of the scientific revolution, that the Earth's at the center of the universe and the sun revolves around it. That was Ptolemy, Claudius Ptolemy. His basic work was done 127 to 141 AD. That is not Hellenistic. Hellenistic period was 323 BC to 31 BC. Hellenistic would be the civilization after Greek fell, really before Rome got going, and Alexander the Great was the guy who pretty much set that up. But I think culturally Ptolemy would have been Hellenistic. That's kind of where I think where I got the idea. So he would have been under the Roman Empire, but still operating out of that Greek sense of inquiry.
There was a Ptolemy that was a general under Alexander. Did you find that one?
I think they're two different guys.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I also mentioned Toynbee, and I also made a mistake there. Here's the book I was referring to, which I think is the best one. I'll pass it around if you're interested. I think Sandy might have got one.
I found one in England.
In England.
One.
Yeah, one.
Yeah, used.
Used even.
Yeah.
I did a search under bookfinder.com, and a couple of them came up.
Oh.
So, anyway, this is the, let me get this straight, this is the edition that Toynbee edited. He didn't like his own editing job, but I recommend it because it's got pictures. And really, it's tough going. This is the one that Toynbee did not edit, edited by a man named Somerville. Toynbee said it's actually, he did a better job of editing it down to two volumes from 12 or 13 volumes. But it's just hard reading. You don't get any pictures. And if you're interested, here's a biography of Toynbee. He's a pretty sympathetic looking guy. Actually, we talked about it in our Saturday class, but I'll mention here, I'll mention it Saturday too. He wrote this book, this is sort of a detour, he wrote this book in response to World War I. His model, he threw out Freud's cause and effect, thank God, and came up with his own model, which I think is very, very interesting, called challenge and response. The people aren't, causes don't cause behavior. Life throws us a bunch of challenges, and then we choose how we respond to them. And that's the model he used for civilizations. And the thing I said in Saturday, which was close but not off, half of his classmates at Oxford were killed in the First World War. I said two-thirds, but it was half. So out of that, out of seeing half of his friends getting killed in the trenches, he wrote that 13th volume. Interestingly, for our Sophia work, Out of a Vision, he was walking down the street in London one day and had a vision of world history as one continuous whole, and wrote 13 books to try to express that. So, and that vision lasted 10 seconds, maybe. He's not accepted in academia, but of course neither is Jung and Joseph Campbell, so that to me just means it's good stuff. Okay, any questions? We pick up on page 30.
On 30?
Yeah.
I brought the painting today because I felt like our text amplified it.
Go ahead. So, over to you.
Well, if you want to talk about...
Or you want to stop me when it gets to be time?
Well, it's all explained on page 30, the amplification.
Sure, I'll read those two dreams?
Yeah, and then, you know, since it seems to... It explains some things to me that I didn't understand. That
Why don't I read a dream, we'll go through the dreams, and then with that knowledge we can go to your painting.
Okay.
This is the dream then after the Inquisition. A head of an old man with white hair bathed in light falls from heaven. I fear it will shatter on the ground, but instead it falls into water, bobs up and down and comes to the surface and proves to be indestructible. A second elderly man appears near the head. And what Pally made of the dream was that it was forecasting the death of a friend of his. A mathematician at the University of Hamburg, remember, Pally studied, that's where he got his PhD in Hamburg. And the text tells us, Pally maintained a friendly relation with Hecke and corresponded with him about philosophical questions. And then the next night, I said the same night, it's actually the next night, a man even more similar to Hecke than in the previous dream is here, though the man is not identical to Hecke. He is surrounded by dark people from Denmark. Remember, Denmark is where they discovered quantum. Who are singing in a choir, true until death.
What did they discover in Denmark?
That's where they discovered the quantum physics. That was in Copenhagen. Then Pally writes, 2 days later, the dream occurred to me again. I became very sad and was certain that Hecke would die. Typo there. This sad event occurred, in fact, on February 13th. Further observation in 1959, this had to do with a typical synchronistic phenomena between an inner situation and an outer event. The dreams are also to be understood on the subjective level, apart from the external event, as the approach of an archetypal unconscious content of the unconscious. Now, let's do a couple of things here all at the same time, so we get real confused. Look at what Pally says. That's rubbish. What he does again and again is give intellectual interpretations to the dreams. That interpretation says absolutely nothing. And we'll be coming back to that in a later dream, which is one reason why I mentioned it now. An approach of an archetypal unconscious content. Yeah, what archetypal unconscious content, Wolfgang? And what's it asking of you? You see, that's where he stops, short, again and again. It's like he's in a theater looking from the back row of a play and describing the actions on the stage with absolutely no relationship to himself. That's not really the main point of what the interpreter says, but it does come up later, and I thought it was a good example of what one of his own dreams will be criticizing him for. Also, I think, by the way, I think the interpreter completely misses the point of the dream. So let's go through what he says, and then I'll tell you what has occurred to me since. He says, I admit that these two dreams are puzzling. Possibly meant by the head of the transfigured man is what in alchemy is called the rotundum. The rotundum in alchemy is a head. On which a alchemical procedure is enacted. Remember, this is a mythological thinking here. And he then cites Jung saying probably all these ideas go back to the severed head of Osiris, which crossed the sea and was therefore associated with the idea of resurrection. That, I think, starts to get closer to the truth. Do you all remember the story of Isis and Osiris? Everybody? Okay, I won't repeat it then.
Well, I don't really remember. I remember reading it, but I didn't. And they were the lovers.
Yeah, Isis and Osiris were husband and wife.
Mm-hmm.
Osiris got into a fight with Set. Mm-hmm. Set was the devil figure.
Okay.
He was often depicted as S. And I'll give you the full version. If I can remember it. Yeah. Set kills Osiris and throws Osiris in the Mediterranean. And Osiris then floats to Lebanon, I think it was, and is washed ashore and is assimilated into the form of a tree. And Isis, his wife, goes looking for him, finds him, rescues him, and brings him back to life. Do you remember that Jed column, D-J-E-D? I should have brought a picture of it along, but I'll try to bring one along next time. You'll recognize it if you see it. It looks like a tree with lines across, and it's pretty common in Egyptian art. That is to represent Osiris in the tree. Osiris gets in another fight with Set, and Set chops him up, this time into 14 pieces, and throws him in the water. And that's what this reference is to, the head of Osiris in the water. And Isis goes out again, collects all but one piece. She can't find his phallus. And she puts them together, and she makes a phallus for him. And on the corpse, or on the resuscitated Osiris, I think, depending on the version, she conceives Horus. And Horus goes and takes revenge and beats up Set. But the idea here is that the Osiris story would be like our Christ story. It's a story of death and rebirth. And what the severed head here would mean that there's been a dismemberment, but that there will be a restitution. Does that make sense? Now, I'll tell you what I think, and then we can go to Tom and then to Carol, because Tom brought along some stuff. I'm just going to give you what I think is the absolute simplest interpretation, and then we can look at what he is saying here in a little more depth. What was Pali not? He wasn't true unto death. He gave up at the end. And I think the dream is simply telling him that. Don't give up until the end. So when he sees that head, what he's seeing is his own capacity to stay true to the process. And by implication, it's a warning. You're not going to stay true to the process. Why would the dream say true unto death if there weren't a danger of being not true unto death? To me, it's so simple, I can't believe they didn't see it. But that's what I would make of it. And Hecker was a guy that Pali had a devoted friendship to. And we'll see as we go down the road, Pali slowly alienated everybody. He alienated Jung, alienated von Franz, and then his last friend was Anila Yaffe, and he alienated her. Just walked into her apartment one afternoon and started insulting her. She said, get out. That was the end of that friendship. the one person he did really kind of maintain a some sort of ongoing relationship with, Marcus Spiritz. We'll be hearing about Marcus Spiritz. Those of you who know the Wheel of Mysteries, his mother wrote that book, Linda Fiertz David. And she had two sons, at least two that I know of, Marcus and Heinz. Heinz was actually on our faculty. He started the Zurich Bird Clinic. And Marcus was the physicist who took Pauli's place after his death. And Marcus said that the way he was able to maintain a friendship with Pauli was he always spoke to Pauli in the formal. You know, in Germany you've got Z and Du. So here you have a lifelong friendship, and they're still calling each other Mr. Fiertz and Mr. Pauli. That's about all the intimacy Pauli could handle. But he never tried to encroach on Pauli's emotional sphere, and Pauli never then lashed out at him, and they were able to maintain a friendship. So that's the first level of this dream that I think it's about. It's simply compensation for his tendency toward infidelity. Tom, you want to give us your spiel on the head? Now there's a level below that, I think. Now we can look at the archetypal dimension of that symbol.
Yeah, I'll pass this around. So. Because the sacred is, because the Kepler flood controversy that Pauli was writing about and interested in got me thinking, well, let's look up this flood character, because I don't know if you remember that Gary and I did a program, Spirit and Matter for Spirit and Place, a couple of years ago, and one of the images that we used present was taken from a Robert Flood book, this Etruscan Historia, which I'm mangling horribly. It's a highly regarded piece of sort of Renaissance alchemy at Rosicrucian Hermetic stuff. So I had some source books at home. I was looking through some things, and I came up just looking for background flood, and then this image struck me, because I just it presaged actually reading about the head, but it struck me. I just sort of bookmarked it, and then we came to this dream in the reading, and it was like, holy cow. So I went back and looked at some of the stuff, and here's, I wonder if the deliverers had a chance to maybe look at this. Because here's the sort of the explication that was given in the book about this particular image that I'm passing around. But it's a short, it's a easy paragraph that kind of explains a little bit about this mystery of the human head, which was done in the early 17th century. And figure 205, which is this image, is very remarkable. It shows how the higher world acts upon the human brain and is, in fact, in its localization of the faculties on the skull, an essay in the science of phrenology, which was to be so fashionable two centuries later. You know, phrenology, where they would suggest that various parts of the head had correlations, correspondences, to use the Hermetic phrase. The celestial world, composed of God and the angels, penetrates directly into the skull. And if you can remember that image, it was sort of a cloud at the very top there, the center of the cloud. That's the angels and stuff. It penetrates directly into the skull, communicating with the soul. The perceptible world, composed of the four elements, communicates with the five senses. Then there is a sphere called the imaginable world, corresponding to the entirely metaphysical sensations of the imagination, which are produced, quote, as in dreams, by non-existent objects, and consequently by the shadows of elements, end quote. The author continues. Hence, we see a system of spheres exactly following the preceding and containing the shadow of the earth and the shadow of the water. And the preceding refers to that image that's in the back of the book, the back of our book here, page A, so figure 40 and 51, which was a flood image. And it's kind of, I structured it very Hegelian, sort of. But at the top, you've got the divine emanations, which then bounce off of the earth, the bottom sort of figure, as it were, and then in the middle is something, the synthesis is created, so to speak. My words, not his, obviously. The two principles of form, of the upper trinity, and the material, the pre-material. Anyway, so that's a reference to that. NKCS atmosphere is exactly following the preceding and containing, quote, the shadow of earth, the shadow of water, the shadow of gross air, and the shadow of tenuous air, and lastly, the shadow of fire. The intellectual sphere and the imaginative sphere are oddly linked by a slender, sinuous worm. Last of all, the author places at the back of the skull the sphere, which he calls memorative or pertaining to remembrance, and he shows it communicating with the spinal marrow. And I don't know if you know, in Tantra yoga, there's the pranic energy flows up, the kundalini energy flows up and down the spine, and it has two components, as Ida and Pingala. And so I thought it's interesting because this guy, Flood, was supposed to be a student of Paracelsus, who allegedly studied in the Far East, as India was called, and would have been familiar with that sort of thing. But he doesn't call it that. He, the spinal marrow. Those things came up. As far as the Flood stuff, can I continue?
Yeah.
Should I?
Yeah. Give us now the interpretation of that.
Yeah. Then, so then they go to Jung. I mean, okay, after getting some of this other stuff, go jump into Jung about, okay, what's this head business about? And I got a couple different sources on that. One, the first one's from Ettinger in The Anatomy of the Psyche. It says it's not immediately evident why the Negredo should be associated with head symbolism. And, you know, the Negredo is supposedly, you know, the start of the alchemical process, the blackness. One reason seems to be the connection between the term head and the top or beginning. Blackness was considered to be the starting point of the work. Ettinger continues, the head is the principal thing. The capital offense is the gravest one involving the loss of one's head. Thus, the connection of the Negredo with head imagery indicates the great importance alchemy attached to this experience. Later on, he says, the castration or separation of the head from the body also belongs to the mors patatio. Jung writes, quote, the heading is significant symbolically as the separation of understanding from the great suffering and grief which nature inflicts on the soul. It is an emancipation of the cogitatio, which is situated in the head, a freeing of the soul from the, quote, trammels of nature. Its purpose is to bring about, as in Dorn, well, there's a archetypal image called Unio Mentalis, its purpose is to bring about the overcoming of the body. And then one final little piece is from Ettinger, is that from another standpoint, the heading extracts the rotundum, the round, complete man, from the empirical man. The head or skull becomes the round vessel of transformation. That's
yeah, thank you.
So it touches on some of the things. Because the guy, the author of our current book, was onto it, but he
didn't quite get it.
No.
And he's onto it, though.
Yeah.
Did you make copies of that for us?
No, but he can be.
Could you? Yeah,
I'm
listening to it.
Yeah.
I'll make up a new email list. I'll pass this around at the break. We got some new folks, so you'll have emails okay. Some folks. So just to sum up, this image of chopped off heads is surprisingly frequent in dreams. You wouldn't think so. What a strange image. And usually when you see it in a dream, you go, yuck. It looks very negative, but something I've learned from, you know, this comparative study into myth is it's not negative at all. And I thought the best sentence that Tom read is from Jung saying, it is a separation of the understanding from the great suffering and grief which nature inflicts on the soul. So it's like our bodies as the source of our desire are the source of our suffering, and getting the head out of there is getting an objective standpoint back on the suffering that our life is involved in. It would represent the difference, say, between well, you see it in therapy quite a bit, that if a certain client's complex is touched and they get upset, it's the difference between acting out of that upset or coming in and being able to talk about that upset as an object for discussion. You see the difference there? Very, very key distinction. One person will say, "Well, you know, you yawned last week. I'm not coming back because you're one more person who doesn't care." That would be when the head and the body are connected. The other person might say, what was the meaning of that yawn? Can we talk about that? I might say, well, where was the energy? So we can get a perspective on the experience. When that sort of capacity is developing in the person, they will dream their head is being cut off. You would think it would mean just something negative, but it really does often portend something very positive. So I think that's below what I was saying. This would be the archetypal aspect of what I was saying, that for Pali to be able to get a perspective on his suffering and not let it turn into behavior was what this image was about. And look at what it followed. It followed the dream of the trial. And that trial was a experience of suffering. So the dream is saying, go through the suffering. Don't act out that suffering, which is, of course, what he always did. He always hurt the people who were trying to get close to him. And the dream is saying, don't do that. Carry that suffering, because you do have the capacity of developing a level of consciousness stronger than what you're feeling. And from that strength, you can go back and investigate that suffering, and it doesn't have to drive your life. So I thought the very important dreams, the writer kind of got it, but to me missed the real practical import of the thing. And then the Osiris image would fit in here as well, in that this was Pali's way to rebirth. To realize, boy, I've been assigned, I've been given an assignment, and it's going to be painful because it's going to cost me prestige, it's going to cost me marriage difficulties, but I am strong enough to sustain that and to complete my task. And then that's why true unto death comes in there. So what the author has said is all relevant, but I just felt it could be put into a little clearer perspective. You have to do with that. No, I think particularly when you contrast these dreams with the previous dream, it makes sense why suffering would appear. Another dimension of it, strangely enough, this might be going a little too far, but the body sometimes symbolizes the past. And you might think, why? Well, because it's something you've always had with you. And so, given that Pali's task was to help chart a new worldview, a new understanding about the nature of reality, that's also what the head could stand for. That new point of view he was to develop, separating it from the past.
So in other words, this head separating is his ability to gain a higher consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Objectivity.
A more objectivity, mm-hmm. perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And you wouldn't interpret it as I guess normally you'd say, well, dude, you don't want to separate your mind and body.
Exactly. Oh, people will generally say, oh, you see, I'm too intellectual, and it's showing how my head and my body are separated. That's the way people will generally respond to it. And I wouldn't say it could never mean that, but if you look at the context, often it's a very positive development. And that means that they are headed for a difficult emotional time and need to remain steady through it. Not go flying off the handle, not stop therapy, not get a divorce, just because there's a bad day. But stay true to consciousness, even though the experience is painful.
So how do you relate to the head looking like
Well, I don't think a dream. I think dreams can have several levels of meaning at the same time, and it could be that it was also picking up on his death. As to the deeper and tenure question, why this man? I would say because it was a man he did maintain a friendship with.
So that was a way of. This dream and having more how that way?
Well, it was showing him, look, you maintained a friendship with him. Now maintain that capacity for friendship with others. Plus, I think it could also have been funded by the fact that God was dying.
So you can have different levels.
Oh, absolutely. I would say you almost always have different levels. Yeah. Well, we just try to pick up the one that's the most psychologically needy.
But if you were working with a person like that, for the person, I would imagine that the fact that that person looked like, I guess he would call him an associate or a friend.
Yeah, he's a friend.
That would be very powerful to him or her. I mean, would they likely kind of center on that fact?
I think our tendency is always to literalize him. And, you know, it's touchy when you're dealing with emotionally charged imagery that my sense was this guy Heckel was one of Pally's closer friends, that I personally would have just left it be. You're asking practically what would I have said. I wouldn't have said anything. I probably just would have let it be. Because I would have known that, or should have known, that his emotions are so strong that now isn't the time. But I would have made a mental note. This guy is going to bolt. And I would be watching for signs down the road of that tendency to bolt. And I might at some future point, if that ever comes up in the discussion, bring it back and say, you know, we talked about the Hecka dream as being about him, but I wonder if it also has a deeper meaning as well. And is there a danger you will not stay true to your task and to the people who are capable of helping you with that task till the end? And he died at 58. You see, that's just too young. I think he would rather die. He would have rather died than go through the pain of the what was being asked of him. Not unintentionally, of course, but under the surface. Carol.
Well, for me, basically, on page 32, this whole conversation amplifies the painting because. In the painting, it seems to be about two aspects of Sophia, as told in the Navajo myth, that she has two aspects. And here she is performing some sort of uniting task in the painting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the theme of the painting is air.
Mm-hmm.
And symbolically, air is thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so in our text it says that the head and the tail have to be united.
Mm-hmm.
And the head is also the egg, which she's holding in her hands up there. And the tail is identified with the Ouroboros,
mm-hmm.
which is also like a galaxy, the mm-hmm. thing where the light is circulating.
Mm-hmm.
And in her actions, she is uniting this tail and head, which is the same thing that our text says that Polly's task is,
mm-hmm.
is to unite the head and the tail.
Absolutely.
But the curious thing to me that the painting shows is that the head has come from her belly.
Mm-hmm.
It's from the body somehow.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
Can you point to those? I think about
those. You've never seen this before, have you?
No.
Okay.
Why don't you give them a quick tour of the whole painting.
Put it here. Okay, so here we have the opening, and this is the tail section that I think in our text is symbolized because here's a galaxy down here, and it's emitting stars, and here's the egg shape, formed from the rocks, and it seems like these stars are being collected up here. So, you know, our text talks about the circulation of the light, the rotation, and uniting the head and the tail. So for me, this is the head and this is the tail. And in the Navajo myths, Sophia is divided into two figures, one called the changing woman who hides in a hole, and the other called the white shell woman. And it, and this seems to be the figure of the white shell woman, and she in fact is holding an egg, which, you know, frequently has a white shell. And I don't know if you can see, the rocks make a pregnant figure. Here's her head and her belly. And this egg that, that traditionally is associated with the head, it seems to me that there's a little piece here that shows that she has taken this egg from the belly. And also it's a place of incubation, which the text says the head is where things are incubated. And here the head and the egg are the place of incubation, just like the belly is. But the thing about this Sophia belly is that it seems that she can take the egg out, and yet she is still perfectly formed. Her pregnancy is, it seems to be sort of an eternal thing. So she can take these eggs out whenever, you know, whenever she does this creative act, this thing that has to do with the circulation.
Carol, back at the time of Descartes, one of the imagery that's used frequently in the way it talked about is that there was a womb-like expulsion from the world. That was how they experienced what happened when they were able to gain perspective, and the locus of understanding moved from outside to inside, which happened when, at the time of Copernicus, when that whole shift began to take place. So I'm looking at this and I'm thinking how they went from this, they had been in like this womb-like experience, now they were expelled from it, and the work has been to, now that they separated from it, to come back into not participation in the seek, because it would never be that, because you come back with consciousness now.
That's the egg,
and
the head.
That's why she keeps birthing these eggs so she's eternally pregnant, because it's a constantly creative process that's happening. I mean, as I'm looking at that, I'm feeling like it just captures all these images I've been reading about in this book.
I wish you'd write that down for us, if you could.
The book is called The Flight to Objectivity by Susan Bordo, and she talks about the whole idea of what she calls locatedness. What happened during this period of time was how people fell out of location. They didn't know where they were anymore. And then she talks about this whole idea of the individuating detail. And she says, what that does is it puts the culture, what she was talking about, in a certain place. So what I think about is the psyche. Each of us has our own individuating detail. That we're thrust from. Does that make sense?
I think so. I wish you would write it out for us. I want to think about that. Yeah.
Well, I think you would probably enjoy this. What's the name of the book? It's called Flight to Objectivity. It's a series of essays on Cartesian philosophy, but she does it from the view of the psychological.
Yes, no, Hart's point of view almost. Huh?
Yes. What she says is that they suck the juices out of these ideas with the separation of this idea of having detachment and clarity as we're looking at knowledge, and what she's doing now is bringing it full circle, but using the same imagery that they used with which they separated from.
So you're talking about a body kind of thinking.
Yes, absolutely. Well, because she talks about the whole thing of being the moon, and she said once they realized the Earth wasn't the center of its universe, everything fell out of place. They basically were expelled from the womb.
So
I'm looking at that, and it's just like, you know, my God, there's the cosmos, but yet it's still connected in this incredible way with the deepest recesses of the Earth.
And somehow it's, symbolically air is, if you take the four elements and relate them to the four functions, air is associated with thinking. So this is some sort of thinking. I know that's somehow connected with the body. And the stars, you could relate to the four functions. And blue is thinking. And I suppose the color of these stars is probably a personal thing, because I'm an intuitive, and then the yellow star is already in the rotundum, already in the egg. And thinking, which is the theme of the painting, seems is the next one, which is being brought up, and then red is feeling, and then green is sensation, which would be my unconscious function, and it's very, very close down here to the Ouroboros.
I'm curious, Carolyn, did I understand correctly when you said to start with that the little points of light are emanating up? Because it just looks to me almost as if they're dripping down, and then the cosmos below is like a like dropping a puddle or something that expands out and creates the world that way. So it's another form of creation. Both the up thrusting and then the downward pull, both are working in tension.
Well, if they were going downward, then the greatest distance would be between these two. That's what tells us which way they're going.
And also, is it the vapor looking like it's pulling up?
And then you have a vapor rising, which is, the air part of the theme of the painting. But if you look at things in slow motion, then you would see if this were dripping downwards, then the distance between these two would be the furthest distance. So, physics of the universe wise, they have to be going upwards. They have to be floating or emitting.
Did you mention the jar? She's coming out of like a vessel. Did you mention
it? No, I didn't mention her vessel. That's another symbol of Sophia. Is the urn or the vessel. And somewhere I read that Sophia's motto is I unite. So she seems to be performing this action. And yet the fact that she is coming from this vessel means that she is also this. So I think that speaks to the Navajo. The Navajo talk about her having this double aspect. And I guess in our last class, we were talking about the two aspects, really, of Sophia, the light and the dark aspect. So this seems to be some action.
So the base, you call that the circulation of light at the base, you call it the Ouro book?
The
circulation of
our
light.
Text does, and yet the circulation of the light looks to me also to be this.
I think it's both. Mm-hmm.
Because it definitely stars are light, and they're somehow they seem
to
be
circulating.
We don't know what's going to happen once they get up here. My fantasy says that there is some sort of circulation going on. Or maybe it's a circulation up here. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Haven't gotten that far yet.
Is the circulation going counterclockwise or clockwise, or did you even know?
I don't know. Well, for this, it's going. Let me take a look. It's going clockwise here, which I guess that makes sense, because if things are going clockwise, they're becoming conscious. So that makes sense. This circulation is clockwise.
How do you know that?
I'm looking at the shape of the galaxy. And you know how when Jung looks at a mandala, he takes the spiral that comes off, and that tells him which way it's rotating. So if you look at a galaxy and look at the way the spirals are coming off, then that tells you which way it's turning.
Oh, you can actually see spirals?
Yeah, if you get close, you can see the galaxy down there. Okay?
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, nice. Thank you, Frank.
So is that a unique painting or one of a kind, or is that often done in that style by the Indian tribe?
Now, what are you asking me?
Is that a unique rendition, or is that often done by several artists in that way.
I don't think
way.
He knows that you did it.
Oh, that's my painting.
Oh, that's...
Yeah. Yeah, I painted.
I didn't know that you were...
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry.
Would
you want to relate it to other works, or is that totally different from anything you've seen?
Well, I'm not seeing anything quite like it. But, you know, there probably are things like it out there. I just haven't found them. I'm looking.
I mean, that doesn't diminish out of just being totally ignorant in this whole earth. I'm asking the ignorant question.
Well, I mean, I think you're right. It makes sense. If it's something that's happening in the psyche, there ought to be other things out there like it, you'd think.
Do you have a stretch? Thank you.